just asking how far back your units, your tanks might pull from the front line when they were...
Well, not very far, because until Caen, if you know your geography, I don't know how many miles, but the whole beach front was 10 to 15 miles deep, so it wasn't very far back to go. So we'd be back 3 or 4 miles back from actual range, but not as they say, there was a very narrow beachhead we had for until after the breakthrough of Falaise.
So it wasn't the practice to keep your tanks in position at the front line?
No.
Why was that?
Well, a tank isn't worth a damn in the darkness. You can't see a thing. And I think, I was never in one, but I think there were some night operations, Jim Tetley would know, where they went in the dark with lights, you know, with the infantry. But basically, no, the tanks at night were drawn back because they were useless. You can't move, you can't see.
Well, the British Columbia Regiment had that very disastrous action, which was so disastrous because they had to navigate at night and basically ended up in the wrong position.
Yeah, I heard that there were some operations that night. We never had any in my personal experience. Mm-hmm.
So were you there for Trackable and Totalize, those operations? Were you involved in them?
No, I don't remember. Do you know the dates?
Would have been in August the 10th, August 12th, 18th.
Well, I was there just before Falaise, so I guess the answer is yes. I don't remember the name.
These would have been around and past Falaise as well. But yeah, I guess those were just involved in closing the gap.
No, I had left at that point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you left August.
Well, I found it about August the 20th. I was pulled out, and I went back to London. My wife was overseas; she was in the Red Cross mm-hmm. in London, and I actually, at the time, she was a little pregnant, so they had moved her out to Netherlands, out in the country.
Is this an old joke? A little pregnant?
Yeah. Well, she came down to stay with me. We were stationed at Leon Solon the month before D-Day. And our tanks were right along the beach. We had no barracks. And I was living in a local pub. And my wife came down to join me for about a week, which was very nice. And Jerry would come over every night. We were right behind the Isle of Wight where all the ships and Mulberry, the dock was there, and Pluto, the pipeline, all the pipeline up, and of course, my wife was intrigued and wanted to know what all the things were. We didn't really know ourselves, mm-hmm. but anyway, she got a little pregnant, and she was there about the 3rd of June, I guess. The local came around when she first came. No civilians were allowed into the area, but she had a Red Cross uniform on, and the old pub keeper said, look, she's a Canadian and she's here for the comfort of her husband and so on and so on. So they let her stay, but on the 4th of June they came around and said, get out. So she had to go back to London. And then we left to board. We boarded on D-Day was supposed to be the 5th of June. As you know, there was one day delay. So we sat on the LCTs for an extra 24 hours, which was not a very happy experience.
Well, in your training for landing at, guessing backing up, jumping around here a bit, but why not? In terms of your training for the Normandy landing, what did that consist of? Obviously the actual chugging through the water, yeah. But then on the beach, what were you trained to do, spot and shoot?
Well, our training was to, and we had maps, photographs that had been taken, I'd say, within 24 or 48 hours prior. So we identified, we knew exactly what we are going to be up against. Mm. Now, as it turned out, one of the concrete pillboxes on our sector was dummy. It was not man. Mm. There was nothing in it. The others were man.
So there was nothing on the beach that you weren't prepared for?
No, we knew. We had had photographs, and we the landing, HR was 7:30, as I recall. And because of the weather and so on, we were supposed to be half an hour ahead of the infantry to clear the beach. Well, because of the weather and the confusion and so on, we virtually landed with the infantry together. But, as I say, my plan was a minimum low tide because the beach was fully mined and they had this H element with the iron and so on.
Right.
With the mines attached to it. So you could still, they were visible. Mm-hmm. That was the object. Some of the tanks did go up on beach mines. They lost their tracks at least. But to answer your question, we knew what we were expecting. We knew what we were about to be confronted with.
And did each tank, for instance, did you have a particular objective?
No. The confusion as such, and that's all I can say, because there was utter confusion.
Right.
And you responded to wherever you saw fire, you attempt to deal with that. Mm-hmm. Now, our tanks were, you never get, you try and stay apart, no?
Yeah.
And so we were all acting independently, I guess I'd say, mm-hmm. and doing the best we could. I couldn't tell you that day whether I ever killed anybody or shot anybody. We threw an awful lot of crap where there was stuff coming at us.
Right.
But you were always on the move, or tried to be on the move, mm-hmm. so that you wouldn't give a city target.
Well, were you personally, I mean, was your tank in the first wave, or?
No. I was not in the first wave. We were, all our tanks were still on the beach when we landed. I mean, A and B, those that had made it, the DD tanks and so on. Mm-hmm. And we were all fighting on the beach together for about, people have asked me before, and I don't really remember, but I'd say within 2 or 3 hours, the thing calmed down. Mm-hmm. And now there was still mortar coming over because they had their naval workers some way back, mm-hmm. and they were zeroed in on the beach. So taking out the beach gun wasn't the end of the problem, mm-hmm. because even the troops that came in an hour or two later, because they were landing constantly, were still under fire.
Right.
From the mortars, and Jerry had heavy artillery back inland, zoned out of the beach also.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what did you do? What did you do then?
I guess I was as confused on the beach as anybody, and I would try to stay as close to the CO as I could, because the command structure. We were looking for direction from the colonel, and some of our tanks did a spectacular job. Jake Powell, who was a CO of one of the 2IC of, I think, the Peace Squadron, literally almost stuck his barrel into a concrete pillbox and took it out completely. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one success story we knew. The other, I think, a lot of the fact that our fire kept Jerry down. I mean, he didn't expose himself. Mm-hmm. They were all dug in, of course, so they weren't. You never saw anybody at all. What you saw was when they were dead or gave up. Some of them actually gave up, not only on the beach, but as we went inland, there were snipers all around and there were troops. I don't know whether they were stationed there or what, but they actually surrendered, and then that was a problem because tanks can't take prisoners.
Right.
So you had to be sure that they were turned over to the infantry, but as I said, the infantry were normally always with us, so the infantry took over the prisoners. But the only Germans one ever saw were either dead or prisoners. Mm-hmm. You never saw them shooting at you, my point.
Right. Well, in this subsequent action, one of the June the 10th, 11th, how did that play out? Did you advance in a unit with infantry towards a position, or
yes,
were you just stationed waiting for the Germans
to come?
No,
we advanced. We advanced with the Queen's Own together.
Were they on the back of your tank, or
moving up? They were, and around. I mean, you mm-hmm. only so many. Because if you swivel your gun, you knock them off. So yes, they were both on the tank and on the ground. And of course,
and how did you advance? With two squadrons up and one back? Or?
I think it was two squadrons up, and each squadron had a company of infantry.
Right.
And we had the C squadron in reserve, and headquarters was in the middle.
Between the three squadrons.
Just behind the two front squadron.
Right.
They say the CO lost his tank. And I guess we were shocked or surprised. We didn't know what we were heading into at the point.
Intelligence hadn't told you you were up against a German tanks?
Intelligence told us the 12th SS Division was there, but we had no idea the firepower and the fact they were all well entrenched and dug in and literally. Now, we had been told that they were about to attack us, that they were going to drive us back to beach. Apparently, this decision was not a plan, put in the plan. It was a momentary decision taken hours before or the day before, because we only got about 4 hours' notice to move.
Right.
As they said, it was going to be late in the day, and it was 1 o'clock at noon we moved, which was a little unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But it showed that it was an emergency move, I guess, on the part of brigade headquarters, as we said. Well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And they weren't ready to move. They were dug in themselves.
They were dug in, yeah.
Invisible, I
presume. That's all, yeah. You never saw them at all. I never saw a German. And you saw your own fellows. The tank blew it up and were able to get out. Some of them survived, some of them didn't.
So the Germans must have advanced after that if they took prisoners, I take it.
Well, we beat the hell out of there as fast. As soon as we saw what the situation was, and they were just mowing down, the poor Queen's Own were taking a hell of a beating, and we were ordered to withdraw, and we withdrew back out of range anyway.
So you went back to RMC and so forth. Were there lessons being learned about fighting German armored or just fighting the war in Europe? Were you learning?
Yes, I think, yes, I was very impressed with the quality and the information that we got on well, we got strategy and tactics and experiences of all the various people. We had artillery there, we had infantry and so on, and the staff were all senior military staff from British Army or Canadian Army or British Navy, whatever, and I only wish that all of us, all officers, had a chance to take a staff course before the fact rather than after the fact.
So you were being trained at RMC to fight the Japanese?
Well, that's the point. We were looking forward to going over with Bert Hoffmeister, who had the 6th Division. And I don't know. I assume they were mostly infantry, although they probably would have some armor with them. But they were demobilized that fall. Well, things were winding down, I guess.
And were those bad infantry, were they zombies as well?
That's a good question. I really can't answer that. I don't know whether they were or not.
Well, against the Japanese, it seems to me that that was, in terms of tank warfare, was probably what you were used to. It was infantry support.
Well, yeah, it would probably be infantry, and it could well have been all of the NRMA, or zombies, as we call them. But thank God they were never sent. And as I say, I ended up in Ottawa, typical Army posting. I was in charge of everything. I knew nothing whatsoever about. Having just come out of France, and the staff college, my job was a staff captain in charge of home war establishments, hospitals, shoemakers, cooks, butchers, that sort of thing. Mind you, it was a job that had to be done, but my personal experience in the Army hadn't trained me for that job.
Right. But the job of an administrator.
Administrator. My wife came. Was able to get home too, and we had a flat way outside of Ottawa, and I'd have to be up at 5 in the morning to get there, because I had to walk into the bus, and I wouldn't get home at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night, and pushing paper, and I had a staff of 3 captains under me, and you know, those that, I don't know, it takes 20 people behind for every man on the front line. I think there's 20 people backing them up, or whatever the number is, I don't know.
Right. Well, the Canadian Army was supposed to have a larger number than most.
Well, it could well be. Even then, now it's worse today, I think.
Well, I'm wondering whether you had, when you were in Normandy before, whether you had good confidence in your commanding officer at the regimental or the brigade level?
Well, that's a good question. I hesitate to speak. Well, they're all gone now. the CO that took us over and run a little camera shop in London, Ontario, you know, there was a NVM regiment, the Hussars. He happened to be colonel, so he took us over. But he wasn't confident. He had no military training at all, really. Mm-hmm. We were all Sunday soldiers.
Right.
And, he was replaced. We left him in England. And we had another chap, named Colonel Caldwell, who came from the Halifax Regiment. Again, a very fine gentleman. He owned a clothing store in Halifax. But he was not military trained. We had one or two RMC graduates with us who, I mean, they just stood out like a shiny light,
mm-hmm.
because you recognize their knowledge and experience. Colonel Caldwell, who took us into France on D-Day, should never have been there. He is a man in his 40s, a very corpulent man. I hate to admit it, but In the first month we were in France, more than once, the IO, the intelligence officer, and I had to literally carry him and put him to bed on the back of his tank. Out stoned, he was an alcoholic. And fortunately, what do you say? He's your commanding officer. But he'd get into the booze, and thank God it never, I can't say it ever affected our performance. But it certainly gave us a lot to worry about. And somebody must have pulled the plug or wised up, because one morning and our brigadier, a fellow named Thomas, same situation. And we caught up with him, and he was sent back, and so was our colonel.
Mm.
So.
And were they replaced?
They were replaced. A fellow named Frank White, who was an RMC graduate, took over. And it was just different as day and night. I mean, they had proper training to run a regiment. The NVAM colonels, which they all were initially, were Sunday soldiers.
Right.
They had the rank, and that's about it.
And they had whatever training that was given to people in those days.
That's right.
Which wasn't much.
Well, backing up, when I was at in engineering in the University of Toronto, that was COTC, and our instructor was a chap, he was a professor, a major from the First War, and he had the First War manual in his hand, and that was the training we got. dig trenches and look after horses and that sort of thing. I mean, that we had no, we didn't have any rifles or anything like that. I mean, we were totally ill-equipped. And I am sure any thousand like myself said, look, if we do nothing else, if we get out of this, when we get back, to be sure we're never caught in this position again. And I'm sad to tell you right now that we're not far off that stage right now with our state of the military as I see it, because we have obsolete equipment. I was in Gagetown some years ago. I was lieutenant governor of the province, and I was invited down there. And they knew I was in the tanks, and they had leopards, I guess they were, the German tanks.
Yes, and I think still do, if we have anything.
Well, yes, I think they still do. Well, they asked me if I'd like to ride in a tank, and I said, certainly. Well, I had a hell of a job just climbing up to get onto it to start with. This is 20 years ago or more. And the different that I drove it, it was all power steering and that. I mean, the difference, there was no difference then. Yet at that point, these were obsolete. The Leopard tank then was obsolete. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that's all they still have, as far as I know. The tanks are today are useless in today's warfare, such as you might know.
That's what Major General Tedley said. Says not everybody agrees with him, he said, but tanks are obsolete because any infantryman can knock them up with the weapons that they're given.
The weapons they have, they're absolutely ridiculous. The personnel, armored carriers, and that sort of thing, which the Americans have, and in Iraq and so on, yes, but tanks per se, to me, are a dodo bird.
Well, in terms of the officers, you must have followed your regiment even though you were. I'm assuming you followed the first Hussars, their adventures in the Northwest Europe, even though you were back. So did the officers who ended up in charge, were they, usually RMC or at least experienced battle?
Well, by that time, those that survived were well experienced in battle and I think quite capable of doing the job. And the casualties, I just looked up this morning to see what they... what the casualty rate was. Do you have access to the eight officers and about 60 men?
Could you repeat that?
We lost eight officers and about 60 men.
On the 11th?
On the 11th of June, yeah. Right. On a roll of those on the 11th of June, 44.
And, so those were all killed then?
They're all killed.
That's
yeah.
Fatalities.
Oh, yeah, and then there were many, many more wounded, too, and taken prisoner. So that's, that was a half a regiment wiped out, literally.
Well, Tedley told me that he was not proud of, I think, the 4th Armored Brigade when he started out in Normandy. But by the end of the war, he was proud that this process of promotion of officers with experience.
I think that's it. I think by the time our boys got after Falaise, the action was sporadic. I followed up with interest and I read about it since, of course, and talked to some of the survivors. They had some rough shows, but nothing like this. Mm-hmm. But I think combination of better training and better experience and lesser opposition, as they were not.
Did the Canadian Army have or did it develop a good way of taking men due for promotion back and giving them some kind of training to be, a colonel of a regiment?
Well,
couldn't just promote up into that position, I presume, without some kind of...
You were promoted in the field if
you had to be.
if you had to be. If your commanding officer was wiped out of your lieutenant, for instance, and the sergeant takes over automatically and is promoted in the field. Mm-hmm. In your upper senior officer field rank, normally that's, as you say, chosen from a broader scope of the whole brigade or from the reinforcement unit. Mm-hmm. And we were getting some Well, they're not RMC because RMC was closed during the war. But we were getting, well, for instance, in my, instead of going to Japan, I went to Ottawa. But a lot of, I was the 12th SS class, a lot of them went back to Europe. So they did get, they were fed back in.
Mm, okay.
Several of my personal friends were fed back to Europe, and they got there, they didn't get home until 1946.
So they came back with you, perhaps, to Ottawa to train for the 6th Division?
That's right.
And went back?
Went back to Europe. Mm-hmm. But I was directed to go to Ottawa, which I was quite happy to do.
You mentioned that your wife served nearby.
She served. She went overseas with the Food Administration at the Red Cross. She had her own business in Toronto. She had a fashion shop in Toronto. And she wrote and said she wanted to come overseas, but you needed your husband's position. Permission. And I said, no. That, I didn't agree at all. But she carried on, and my fellow officer said, look, my wife's been in the Red Cross for 3 years, and there's no chance that I won't get over. But finally, I agreed. So within about 6 weeks, she was overseas, but they just set up Food Administration. Mm-hmm. They had driving and hospital and that sort of thing. And
she sounds like a determined woman.
She was, and she still is. Anyway, she came over. Presumably, she was trained to cook with W. Wax in Toronto, with using powdered eggs, powdered milk, all that sort of thing. And they were supposed to go overseas to train the British cooks in the Red Cross clubs in London. Well, and be a director or a dietitian. She went over, she ended up as the cook. She was cooking for 100 and some odd officers 3 times a day in an old-fashioned cook stove in the basement of a big house in West End of London. And
was this like a residence, an officer's?
She was in the junior officer's club. There was a junior officer's club.
Oh, okay.
Another ranks club, and a nursing sister's club. She was in the junior officer's.
She moved back to Canada when you moved.
Well, when I got there, she had just reported being pregnant at the end of August, and so she was immediately sent out of London to a place called Nettlebed up near Reading, someplace. The buzz bombs had started, and the V2s were coming in.
Right.
In fact, when I got off the ship and got to London, and I got a cab and told me, don't want to take me 88 Queensgate. And he said, are you sure? And I said, yeah. He said, I'm sorry to tell you that it's not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we went, and what had happened, the buzz bomb had landed right between the two houses. It had taken all its windows and doors out, but it was, anyway, nobody was killed. But she, in the meantime, she was out in the country. So I arranged for her to get, she came back before I came back before she did. I met her at Union Station in Toronto. There was a picture in the paper meeting my wife come home from overseas.
A bit of a reverse.
A bit of a reverse, yeah.
Well, it sounds like then the Red Cross was fairly cooperative in getting people to be with their partners.
Well, they weren't expecting them to get pregnant when they went over. But, General Price, and we may have heard of, Basil Price, who was commander of the 2nd Division, he didn't take them into Dieppe, fortunately. Anyway, two of his daughters went over to the Red Cross. But before my wife, actually, they both got pregnant. Their husbands were in England. And so it wasn't a very good example. He was made head of the Red Cross in London.
Right.
And two of his own daughters got pregnant. So they had to send them home. But they did a very good job. In fact, my wife and the ladies in Victoria have written a book that's been published.
Yeah.
And it's in the library at the university. And they did a great job in hospitals. And come in.
I don't like to interrupt. But I was going to use lunchtime.
Well, okay, we won't be long. Okay.
Okay.
I just telling Steve about your Red Cross experience.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. See you shortly.
All right.
Well, this is coming to an end. And so you were in the Army till 1946?
No, 1945. I came home in the end of August 44. And I was in RMC till the first year, 45, and then I was in Ottawa till September 46.
Okay.
I was demobbed. As soon as VEA Day was declared on what, May the 8th, was it? Mm-hmm. I put in for discharge, and I was frozen by September. And some of my buddies were still in Europe for another year or so.
And then you went back to university?
No, I didn't. I came out, and at that point, I had a wife and child, and no money, of course. And I debated, because I could have gone back and finished it in a year, and I'll never know whether it was the right decision or not. But in those days, there were jobs lined up waiting for people.
Mm-hmm.
So I got myself a job, $50 a week, and raised a wife and family, and bought a car and so on, and never looked back.
Good. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Does that cover the... I'm afraid I'm a bit disjointed, and, you know, 60 years ago, a lot happens, you forget.
Yeah, well, I think my questions were probably a little all over the map, but it was an interesting interview, and this information is valuable.